Martha Wexler, NPR News, Moscow.
Back in the U.S., the number of people filing unemployment insurance may have gone up last week. However, the overall level is still low enough to suggest an improving jobs market. According to the Labor Department, applications rose by 8,000 last week, and the less volatile four-week average also increased slightly. However, the level of claims is still around the lowest it's been in nearly 4 years. Seeing gains in U.S. stocks so far, with the Dow up 60 points, nearly half a percent at 12,897. NASDAQ Composite Index up nearly 1% or 29 points at 2,965. And the S&P 500 gaining 11. It's at 1,364. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Cabot Creamery Cooperative, supporting Reward Volunteers, an iPhone app for tracking community service at rewardvolunteers.coop.
Programs on WILL are made possible by Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
On the next Fresh Air, Maya Rudolph. The Saturday Night Live alum co-starred in Bridesmaids. She plays a TV talk show host in the series Up All Night. And she co-stars in the new movie Friends with Kids. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson, the producer. Jason Crawford, the controls this hour. Kyle Mabry was on for hour number one. In this hour, we'll be doing a program from the Focus Archives. I do want to mention one more time, we had scheduled this morning a conversation with Tim Johnson as part of the series of conversations we're doing with candidates in the March primary. He was not able to be with us this morning because he's in Washington doing his job as a member of Congress. There were a number of votes scheduled for this morning, and unfortunately the press of business made it so that he could not be with us. We'll see if we can get him rescheduled for another day. In the meantime, we're doing a program from the Focus Archives, a show we first broadcast last August. In this hour, we'll not take calls. Millard Fillmore was a rather undistinguished politician from upstate New York when he was picked to be Zachary Taylor's running mate. When Taylor died, a little bit more than a year into his term as president, Fillmore became president. And at a time of great crisis, fate put into the White House a man ill-prepared to be the leader of the nation. In this hour focus, we will be looking back to the life and times of America's 13th president, Millard Fillmore, as we talk with legal historian Paul Finkelman. He's professor of law at Albany Law School. He's a specialist in American legal history, race and the law. He's an expert in areas that include the law of slavery and constitutional law. And he is the author of a recently published biography titled Millard Fillmore. It's published by Times Books, and this is a part of a series of brief presidential biographies published by Times Books, and there are a whole number of them. So if you're interested, you might take a look at the list, and it's quite a long list of presidents that have been profiled. This one has just recently come out, and we're pleased that Professor Finkelman could spend some time talking with us. And Professor Finkelman, hello.
Hi, very nice to be here.
Well, thanks very much to talk with us. I think it's probably fair to say that Millard Fillmore is maybe one of the least well-known presidents, seems generally acknowledged to have been one of the worst, but he certainly was a president at a time when we were wrestling over one of the biggest issues that we've had in this country, and that's slavery, and particularly the question of would there be slavery in the expanding western part of the United States.
That's correct. And, of course, it has a direct relationship to Illinois' most important contribution to American history because Abraham Lincoln would eventually run on a platform that said no more slavery in the West.
Mm. It seems, and I'm sure we'll talk about this in some detail, but, you know, that on the one hand, it seems that if you know just a little bit about him, you might say that he actually ended up bringing the nation closer to war. Certainly his fellow Northern Whigs were pretty unhappy with him because they thought he was too accommodating to what the South wanted. On the other hand, war was held off, at least for a few years. And I wonder how you come down on that question. Well, did he actually make it more likely that the war occurred, or by his action, did he at least, do we give him credit for pushing the war off a little bit?
Well, it depends on what you think of the inevitability of something like the war. That is, too often we look at history from hindsight. We say, well, we know what happened, and therefore we know it had to happen this way. So the question is, would the war have occurred in 1850 if there's no compromise? And there are some Southerners who are talking about secession. There is a secession convention called for the spring of 1850, which is an abysmal failure. And then there's one the following November, which is even worse of a failure for the secessionists. They run secession tickets and sort of anti-union tickets all over the South, and they're defeated in one state after another. Now, one argument would be, well, they're defeated because the Compromise of 1850 passes. The other argument is they're defeated because cotton prices are enormously high and there's great prosperity, and who wants to rock the boat when everybody's making lots of money? A further problem would be, if we imagine Southern secession in 1850, who's going to lead them? John C. Calhoun dies that summer. There is no known leader of the Southern nationalists, as they call themselves. That is people who want to have a Southern nation. Somebody like Jefferson Davis doesn't emerge at this time. It takes a number of years for him to become the leader of this movement. So I don't see secession as being particularly plausible in 1850, and therefore one could imagine a compromise that is less awful. The Compromise of 1850 in many ways is a complete catastrophe, in part because it gives the South everything it wants and really gives nothing to the North. And so it's more of an appeasement than a compromise.
He was the last, he was a member of the Whig Party, and he was the last Whig president.
Right.
And it wasn't very long after that the party just ceased to be. I'm sure that the debate over slavery helped to tear the party apart, and so it may have ceased to be in any case. But was he in some way to blame for the death of the Whigs?
No, I think he killed the Whig Party. To set the stage, he's elected vice president in 1848, running with the hero of the Mexican War, Zachary Taylor. Zachary Taylor is an odd presidential candidate. He had never voted in an election in his life. He had never held any public office other than as a military officer. He, in fact, had been in the military since he was in his late teens, and never done anything else. He did own a few sugar plantations in Louisiana, which I guess he watched over when he was on leave from military duty, but he was a professional soldier. And as I said, never voted for anything. But you don't get to be a major general in the Army without some political sophistication. He runs with this completely unknown, obscure candidate from upstate New York who's only served four terms, not even consecutive terms, in the U.S. House of Representatives, and is in the first year of his election as the Comptroller of New York. Now, being the Comptroller of New York is an important job, but I don't think it makes you vice presidential material.
Mm-hmm.
Fillmore gets the job. He's completely isolated from Taylor. He doesn't even meet Zachary Taylor until 2 days before the inauguration. This is suggests something about the difference between then and now, that the vice president and president didn't know each other until almost the moment that they're inaugurated. He becomes president when Taylor dies suddenly, and he is an incompetent from day one. Whenever there's an accidental president, whenever the president dies and the vice president takes over, the cabinet members always offer a what we call a pro forma resignation. They hand the president a resignation letter saying, basically, I am with you, Mr. President, but when you decide you want me to go, you already have my resignation in advance. Every cabinet has done this. Almost never does the president turn to any of these cabinet members and say, oh, well, you can leave today? Fillmore fires them all. So his first day in office, his very first act as president, is to accept the resignation of every one of the cabinet members. So here you have a very inexperienced person as president with no cabinet. There's a crisis over the territories in the West and southern demands for fugitive slave law. Texas is threatening to invade New Mexico. And Fillmore has no cabinet. I mean, this is not a very auspicious way of beginning your presidency. Hmm.
And the story is apparently that the reason that he accepted the resignation of all the cabinet members is that he felt that somehow they had not paid due deference to him when he was vice president.
Yeah. He was hurt because he wasn't invited to cabinet meetings. But the fact is, vice presidents were never invited to cabinet meetings at this time. Shouldn't say never. Occasionally they were, but very rarely. When you see official portraits of the president's administration, the vice president is not always there. There's a famous Matthew Carpenter painting of Lincoln giving the Emancipation Proclamation to the cabinet. Vice President Hannibal Hamlin is not in that picture. There is an official photograph of the Taylor administration. Fillmore is not in it. The vice president is not considered to be part of the inner circle. But Fillmore, not understanding this or simply being a deeply insecure individual, gets his revenge by firing the cabinet. One more piece of the fall of the Whig Party is in 1852, Fillmore's trying to get the nomination on his own. He goes to his people go to the convention. The candidates never show up at the conventions in those days. His people go to the convention with about 20 votes short of getting the nomination. Winfield Scott, who is the other general who helped win the Mexican War, is the other candidate for president. He also is 20 or so votes short of getting the nomination. Daniel Webster, who is in Fillmore's cabinet, he is Fillmore's Secretary of State, he has more than enough votes at the convention to give Fillmore the nomination. The nomination goes for more than 30 ballots with nobody getting enough votes. And throughout this time, Fillmore's own Secretary of State is preventing Fillmore from getting the nomination. Both Webster and Fillmore agree that if Scott's the candidate, he'll be a disaster. And he is. He's a terrible candidate. But neither of them are willing to sit down in a room where Fillmore says, look, I'm president, and you're in my cabinet. Release your delegates and get me nominated. Webster, by this time, is way too old to be president. He's sick. He'll die. If he'd been nominated, he would have died before the election anyways. He's in no shape to be president. But he stubbornly holds on to these delegates. And Fillmore doesn't have either the brains or the guts or the political savvy to call his Secretary of State to the White House and say, release your delegates or quit my cabinet now because you're fired.
It seems if you look at the man's life story and go back to his certainly humble beginnings, he seemed to be somebody who was always quite conscious of that, conscious of the fact that he was born in a very poor family, that he really didn't get a very good education, and he seems to be someone who had a struggle with a lifelong sense of insecurity. That was a real serious problem because it meant that he didn't really deal well with people who disagreed with him.
He's very stubborn. He's very insecure. He doesn't know how to deal with people. He's either sucking up to people who he sees as his superiors, his betters, if you will, or he's trying to compensate in some other way for feeling insecure.
You know, it seems I'm sure we could point over time, we could point to a number of examples of somebody who ended up being a candidate for vice president. When you start to look at the time when people actually ran together, candidates for vice president, you have to sort of scratch your head and say, why did they pick that person? And this is certainly one of those cases. When he was chosen to be Taylor's running mate, what did they think that they were getting out of that?
They thought they were getting a northerner who would bring northern votes to the election. One of the things to remember is that in those days the tickets usually were balanced between a northerner and a southerner, and so they had to have a northerner who could be on the ticket, and the best northerner were eliminated at the convention in one way or the other.
So they think that
kind of a ticket balancer.
Yeah.
And what else happens is at the convention? It's fascinating. The supporters of Fillmore run. The big political issue is something called the Wilmot Proviso. The Wilmot Proviso had been a proposal in the House of Representatives that no new land acquired from Mexico would be open to slavery. This passes the House of Representatives overwhelmingly, but it fails in the Senate. And so at that point, the debate in the 1848 election is, what are we going to do with the territories? Fillmore's supporters at the convention run around saying, well, he's from upstate New York. He's opposed to the spread of slavery into the territories, which turns out not to be true. He doesn't care one way or the other about slavery in the territories. So he's sold to the northerners as a good northern man when he's not. And then they run around and sell him to the Southerners as somebody who has never taken a position on slavery, which is entirely true and is therefore not hostile to slavery.
Hmm. Our guest in this hour of focus is Paul Finkelman. He is the President William McKinley Distinguished Professor of Law at Albany Law School. He's a noted specialist in American legal history, race, and constitutional law, and is the author of a new book that is a brief biography of President Millard Fillmore, the 13th President of the United States. It's published by Times Books, and it's part of a series of brief presidential biographies. Questions are certainly welcome. We have somebody here ready to go, and it's somebody who is on a cell phone here in Champaign, so we'll go right there, line four. Hello.
Yeah, David, thanks for taking my call. I want to thank your guest for bringing to light whom I suppose we would consider a poster boy for obscure presidents. So this is a very interesting topic. Just a very, very quick aside, my mother-in-law in the 1950s worked for Chicago Title and Trust, and her boss was, I believe, the great-grandson of Millard Fillmore. So I don't know if there was just happenstance or there was some sort of Chicago connection, but anyway. What brings to light is the old humorist Will Rogers' comment on Calvin Coolidge, that he didn't do anything, but in fact that's what the American people wanted at the time. I always got that feeling from Fillmore, about Fillmore, but listening to your guest, it sounds like, as opposed to him not doing anything, he was just completely incompetent. And I'm always struck by how these people find themselves in a position of such authority and power, end up through happenstance, whatever, to get there. But just wanted to add that. Very interesting show. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Well, Professor Finkelman, I don't know, you want to comment on any of that?
Well, yeah, I think that doing nothing is not always the best thing. And, in fact, Fillmore is not a do-nothing president. Let me run the compromise of 1850 by your audience.
Sure, yeah. Yeah.
Understand what goes on.
Uh-huh.
In 1820, backing up 30 years, Congress passed what was known as the Missouri Compromise, which said there would be no slavery in any of the western territories after Missouri came into the Union. The only exception to that would be what is today the state of Oklahoma, which was a western territory, and Arkansas. But everything north of Missouri or west of Missouri, the Great Plains, the upper Midwest, that was all closed to slavery. So you couldn't have slavery in Iowa or in Kansas or Nebraska or the Dakotas. Then we fight the Mexican War, and we suddenly get this vast amount of territory, which includes most of or all of the present-day states of California, Arizona, New Mexico, Utah, Nevada, Colorado, a good chunk of Wyoming. All of this is now added to the United States. What are you going to do with these territories? One thing would be to extend the Missouri Compromise line across the country so that Arizona and New Mexico are open to slavery. Utah, Nevada, Colorado are not. California's an exception because by the time the debate takes place, there are already almost 100,000 people in the state. They're insisting on statehood, and they want to come in as a free state. Even the strongest pro-slavery Southerners admit that California has to come in as a free state because that's what the majority of the people want. So that's one issue. What do you do with the territories? The other issue is the Southerners are demanding a new fugitive slave law. And Fillmore signs a law which is one of the most outrageous violations of fairness that's ever been passed by Congress. The 1850 Fugitive Slave Law does not allow an alleged fugitive to have a jury trial, does not allow a court to issue a writ of habeas corpus to review the case, does not allow the alleged fugitive to even testify at his own hearing. So if you're grabbed on the streets of Chicago as somebody's fugitive slave, you can't say, wait a minute, you got the wrong guy. And of course, there are no photographs, there's no DNA testing, there's no fingerprints. It's simply some description. So if a Southerner walks into your town and says, I'm looking for John, and he's 5'7" and weighs about 140 pounds, and he's black, then this guy can just walk around until he sees somebody who fits that description, says, this is John, and the guy he grabs can't say, no, I'm not. Because he's not allowed to testify. The person hearing the case, a federal commissioner, would get $5 if he decides the person before him is not a slave, but he'd get $10 if he decides he is a slave. So it looks like they're trying to buy justice. Fillmore signs this law. He happily signs this law. He vigorously enforces it. He says that people who are opposed to the law, who even speak out against it, are traitors because they're opposing the law. But it violates every aspect of due process. And that undermines his presidency. That makes him a hated man in much of the North. That helps destroy the Whig Party. And for what? So that Southerners can go and grab runaway slaves easily without any hearing.
You know, Fillmore himself, apparently, at least at one point, said or wrote that he personally detested slavery. He grew up in in the North, and he grew up in a place where probably most of the people in the area where he grew up opposed slavery. And at the same time, it seemed that he was surprisingly yielding to the interests of the South and of slaveholders. What can be said, do you think, about his attitude toward slavery?
Well, he writes a letter to Daniel Webster where he says, God knows I hate slavery, as I say in my book. Yeah. It may be that the Lord knew he hated slavery, but nobody else would have from any of his actions because, in fact, he never lifts a finger to fight slavery. He signs the Compromise of 1850, which opens all of the Western territories that have been acquired from Mexico to slavery, except California. So he's going to allow slavery in all of this area north of the Missouri Compromise line, would have allowed Utah, Nevada, Colorado to become slave states. Now, some people say, well, you couldn't grow cotton there. That's true, but slaves are very useful if you're interested in mining things, and those are mining states. Slaves have been used as cowboys, as herdsmen. You could use slaves to watch your sheep or your cows in Colorado, to mine silver, to mine other minerals. Slavery would have been profitable in those states, and the Southerners knew it. They're demanding access to those states. So he gives the South all this new territory. He signs this fugitive slave law. He vigorously prosecutes it. At one point, he calls in the local U.S. attorney from eastern Pennsylvania, from Philadelphia, and insists that the man indict people for treason for simply refusing to help a federal marshal capture a fugitive slave. These people didn't even interfere with the marshal. The marshal said, I want to deputize you. And these people said, no, we won't be deputized. We're not going to do this. And now he could have prosecuted them under the federal law, fined them, maybe sent them to a small jail sentence. But instead he is going for the only, at that time, the only capital offense in federal law, treason. Wants to hang these people because they literally hang them because they refuse to help enforce the fugitive slave law. Other side of this, at the same time all this is going on, there are people in the South who are trying to invade Cuba and take it over. They're known as filibusters. This is against federal law. There are a number of laws which prevent Americans from going invading other countries. When a group of these people invade Cuba and are captured, Fillmore does everything possible to help them come back to the United States, brings them back, and doesn't charge any of them with any crime. So if Southerners break the law and perhaps almost get us into a war with Spain over invading Cuba, Fillmore says, well, I'll help you Southerners because I want to get your votes in the next election. But if Northerners simply refuse to help the fugitive slave law, that's treason in Fillmore's book. Very uneven and very pro-slavery all the time. One more thing. When he's running for vice president, there's a rumor that somebody puts in a newspaper says that Fillmore once helped a fugitive slave escape. And Fillmore writes this really angry letter saying anybody who knows me knows I would never help a fugitive slave. Well, for his northern neighbors, that's nothing to brag about. Most of them would have helped a fugitive slave.
When the war started, the Civil War starts, he, and this is after he's out of the presidency, he actually supports it and supports Abraham Lincoln, but later turns against both. He actually opposed emancipation.
Yeah. Fillmore is a unionist in 1860, although he doesn't vote for Lincoln. It's interesting. Lincoln and Fillmore knew each other in Congress. Lincoln was a Whig before he becomes a Republican. Almost all of the Whigs go into the Republican Party. Fillmore does not. Fillmore votes for something called the Constitutional Union Party in 1860. But when secession begins and the war begins, Fillmore supports the Lincoln administration for about the first year of the war. And then he turns on Lincoln, and he turns on the war effort after the Emancipation Proclamation. He says he no longer supports the war. He votes for a Democrat in 1864. He votes for General McClellan, who's the peace candidate. And Fillmore is invited to give a speech in Buffalo to raise money for wounded soldiers. And everybody expects him to give a patriotic speech. He's a former president. He's the most famous citizen of Buffalo. And he gets up and he gives a speech in which he denounces the war and says we're destroying the most beautiful part of America by invading the South. And people in Buffalo are absolutely shocked. Newspapers that had been Fillmore papers for his entire political career denounce him. People call him a traitor. I mean, he's not a traitor. It's not treason to do this, but he's certainly not a patriot in the sense that most people in Buffalo would have thought a patriot should act.
And what do you think his motivation was? What was he thinking?
I think deep down inside, Millard Fillmore is not comfortable with anybody who isn't exactly like him. The other piece of his political career is that he is a member of the Know Nothing Party in 1856, which is a party formed to oppose Catholic immigration to the United States. One of the platforms of the Know Nothing Party is that no Roman Catholic should ever be allowed to hold public office in the United States. Fillmore runs for president in 1856 as the Know Nothing candidate. Before that, Fillmore had been involved with other what are known as nativist parties, that is, parties that oppose immigration. In the 1840s, he had been involved with something called the North American Party. Fillmore has a long record of being hostile to Catholics. He doesn't like Catholics. He doesn't have any sympathy at all for black people. He sees no problem in returning a slave who has been brave enough and smart enough and clever enough to figure out how to run away and get to the North, somebody who one would think you'd admire because this is a person who's striving for freedom, which is the American creed. Even if you understand that the person is still a slave, you have to admire somebody like this. Fillmore doesn't. Fillmore just wants to round them up and send them back. And so he doesn't have any sympathy to black people. He hates Catholics. While he's president, he proposes a treaty with Switzerland that is blatantly discriminatory against Jews, And Fillmore sees nothing wrong with this treaty. He's happy to propose it until somebody in the Senate objects to the anti-Semitic parts of the treaty. And then Fillmore says, oh, well, we'll have to go back and renegotiate. But in fact, the renegotiation doesn't change the treaty. It simply softens the language. But the outcome is exactly the same. So this is a man who is uncomfortable with people who are not exactly like him. And so that explains his opposition to emancipation. It explains his anti-Catholicism. It explains his support of anti-Semitic legislation.
In this hour of focus, we're talking with Paul Finkelman. He's professor of law at Albany Law School. He's an expert in American legal history, race, and the law, areas like the law of slavery, constitutional law, someone who is particularly interested in some of this history that we're talking about here, the Fugitive Slave Act, the Compromise of 1850. That's, I think, how it is that he got involved in this particular project to write the book. And if you'd like to read it again, the title of the book is Millard Fillmore. It's published by Times Books. It's part of their series on the American presidents. And there is a long list of biographies of other presidents, so you might want to take a look at it. How was it that Millard Fillmore actually got involved in politics in the first place?
Well, he got involved in politics with another sort of weird third-party movement. And in fact, one way of seeing his career is that he is, I think he's the first Tea Party president. Or the first Tea Party successful politician. He is as a man who is involved in kind of wacko conspiracy theories one after another. So his first foray into politics, he's a member of something called the Anti-Masonic Party. Now, you know, when we see the Shriners on their motorcycles in a parade with their hats, it's kind of hard for us to imagine that it could be a political party opposed to the Masons. But there was, in the 1830s, there was this view that the Masonic Order was a vast conspiracy that was trying to take over America. People like Andrew Jackson and George Washington had been Masons. So if you opposed Andrew Jackson, then you were a member of the Anti-Masonic Party. One piece of the Anti-Masonic Party was that they were against privilege. They saw the Masons as a privileged group. And they were more fundamentally democratic. But Fillmore doesn't seem to fit in that part of the anti-Masonic party. Rather, he, I think, is attracted to the idea of some external conspiracy threat. So he starts out as an anti-Mason, then he becomes a Whig, but as a Whig, he's always flirting with the anti-Catholic groups like the North American Party and then the Know Nothing Party. So it's just from one thing to the other. And then he ends up supporting the Constitutional Union Party in 1860 and then voting for the peace general who would have backed away from emancipation, McClellan, in 1864.
Well, we have another caller here. We bring them into the conversation. The caller's in Effingham on our line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I understand the professor's take on the Compromise of 1850, that it was a boon more for the South than the North, but were there not Southern politicians who were hurt because they opposed it? And I'm thinking, or perhaps I'm totally off the base, because they supported it. Was Sam Houston not affected negatively by this?
Sam Houston was, in fact, very successful after 1850. He remains in the Senate, and then he's elected governor of Texas. Sam Houston
I know that, but it seems to me that in Profiles in Courage there was some measure brought out that there was kind of a dichotomy in which the nation rewarded these people. Webster's northern supporters felt that he had betrayed them because of his support of Clay, but that Houston, too, took some, or was it Thomas Hart Benton? Somebody took some heat, did they not?
Thomas Hart Benton took some heat in Missouri, and Houston took some heat in Texas.
Okay.
But the fact is that Houston, of course, remained a viable politician in Texas.
Yes.
And his governor, when Texas secedes,
yes,
refuses to secede. Deserves to be enshrined in some great hall of fame for American patriotism for his refusal to accept secession.
I agree with you totally.
Unlike, say, the current governor of Texas, Rick Perry, who thinks secession's a good idea. But, yes, politicians take heat for whatever they do. The point is if you're going to have a compromise has to be a law which both sides get something on. And there's very little in the Compromise of 1850 that Northerners could come back and say, well, look what we got.
I agree with you. I know. But tell me, why on earth did the Whigs ever pick Fillmore as a VP candidate? Why would you want somebody so...
unknown.
Well, unknown and not functional, really.
Well, they don't know he's not functional because they don't know him. What happens is the convention has just picked Zachary Taylor to be the candidate. He's a Southerner. He's a Southern planter. He owns hundreds of slaves in Louisiana. And so the convention now has to have a Northerner to balance the ticket.
Okay.
There are a number of viable Northern candidates. There is a politician in Ohio who probably would have been a very good vice president, would have been a much better president than Fillmore. His name is put in nomination, and one of his political opponents in Ohio gets up and says, he's just told me, I just got a letter from him saying that he doesn't want to run for vice president. Well, this isn't true. This man in the Ohio delegation hated this guy, and he's simply stabbing him in the back. He had not ever said that he didn't want to be vice president.
Of course not. I understand.
Okay, so he's eliminated. There's a candidate from Massachusetts, a former congressman, who probably would have been much better. He was a sophisticated man. He was also very, very wealthy and offered, in fact, basically to fund the entire presidential campaign himself. But in 1844, he had supported Henry Clay instead of Daniel Webster for the presidency. And so the Webster people in Massachusetts say, we're not going to support this guy. So here you have another viable political candidate who is killed off. The last very viable guy is William Henry Seward, who has been governor of New York, who is very much anti-slavery, who would have been a great ticket balancer in the sense that you would have had the slave-owning Taylor running with the anti-slavery Seward. And
right.
Seward is a very smart lawyer, and with Seward, you either love him or hate him. And many of the Whigs hated Seward. One of Seward's great faults was that he was not only smart, but he knew how smart he was.
Yes, so he was
arrogant. So, how do you block Seward? By finding another New Yorker. And furthermore, if a New Yorker becomes vice president, then Seward can't become Secretary of State because you can't give the leading cabinet position to another New Yorker if there's a New York vice president. So,
well, I thank you very much, and I want to read your book now because I'm really ignorant about Millard Fillmore, and I'm ashamed of myself.
Most people are. I mean, he's not a well-known guy.
And so it sounds almost as if somebody said, "Well, here's a particular person who might make a good candidate," and somebody had an objection. Here's somebody else, and somebody else had an objection, and then somebody said, "Well, does anybody object to Millard Fillmore?" And nobody did. So he was sort of the default vice president.
You don't know who he is.
Yeah.
In one sense, it's a lesson for the American people that you shouldn't run a vice presidential candidate when you don't know who the person is. Think of Richard Nixon, who is looking for a Southerner to balance his ticket, and he chooses this utterly unknown, completely obscure, minor politician who's been governor of Maryland for a couple of years, and before that was the chief executive of the Baltimore County government, and then before that, he was the chairman of the school board. I mean, that's his whole political career. Turns out that Spiro Agnew is corrupt, that he's been taking bribes, that he has to leave the vice presidency in disgrace to avoid a federal prosecution and an almost certain conviction for taking bribes. Why? Because nobody knew who the vice president was. Nixon was looking, I think, for someone who wouldn't overshadow him. Instead, he got somebody who was really awful. So I think the lesson is that you want to have a vice president who can step into the president's office if necessary.
We're talking this morning in this hour, we're focused with Paul Finkelman. He's professor of law at Albany Law School. He's a specialist in American legal history, race, and the law. He is the author of a recently published biography of Millard Fillmore, the 13th president of the United States. It is part of a series of brief presidential biographies. It's published by Times Books, and there are a long list of them. Well, it may be kind of grasping at straws to look for something positive to say about Fillmore, but at least one might acknowledge that he does seem to get some kind of credit, or maybe should get some kind of credit, for seeing American interests in the Pacific. And in fact, he was apparently the person who was involved in sending Matthew Perry to open Japan.
Let me give you the best case for Fillmore.
Yeah, okay.
He's a very hardworking guy. He has come up from abject poverty. Along with Lincoln, he is probably the poorest person to ever become president. He works very hard to get where he is. And he's not a stupid person. He has some vision. And one of his visions is of a great commercial America, an America selling things to the world. So three of the things that he supports are a transcontinental railroad, building a railroad from the Atlantic to the Pacific, building a canal across Central America. In those days, they're thinking Nicaragua, not Panama.
Mm-hmm.
And opening trade to Japan. Japan in the 1850s was a closed society. With the exception of a few Dutch traders who were allowed in one town in Japan, Japan was basically closed to the Western world. Sailors who were shipwrecked off Japan were usually taken to Japan and put in jail because foreigners weren't allowed to come to Japan. And there was no trade between the United States and Japan. And Fillmore decides it's time to do something about this. So he organizes an expedition led by Commodore Matthew Perry to go to Japan, float into Tokyo Bay, and by the force of the presence of these steamships with cannon and sailors and all this modern equipment, essentially force the Japanese to accept a relationship with the Western world. And he does this for good or evil. He opens Japan. The Japanese are not happy about this because it changes their society. They quickly become an industrial power afterwards. And this could be seen as a very forward-thinking idea. The funny thing is, of course, by the time Fillmore's expedition gets off the ground, Perry's expedition, Fillmore's on his way out of office. So, in fact, when Perry reaches Japan, Franklin Pierce is president, not Millard Fillmore.
Yeah.
And so this great idea, the glory goes to his successor. Similarly, he proposes the Transcontinental Railroad, but Lincoln is the one who finally gets it off the ground. He proposes a canal across Panama or Nicaragua, but of course Teddy Roosevelt will be the one who does that. He also prevents the French from annexing Hawaii because he understands that someday the United States might want to annex Hawaii, but of course it will be William McKinley, not Fillmore, who will do the annexing. So even in his vision of expansion, in his vision of technological innovation, like the railroad or the canal, it's somebody else who's going to do it. Fillmore has the right idea, but he doesn't know how to get it off the ground.
Yeah. He was one of the founders of the University of Buffalo, and it served as chancellor, the first chancellor of the school, and it's still there. I think isn't that the biggest school in the state university system?
That may be true. I don't know. I'm at Albany Law School, which is a freestanding private law school, founded actually right about the time that Fillmore was president. We're the oldest freestanding law school in the country. And so I don't really know which of the SUNY campuses are the biggest, but certainly Buffalo is a major university. It's a very good university.
Yeah.
And Fillmore is the first chancellor. He is a great citizen of the city of Buffalo. You might remember some years ago somebody came up with something known as the Peter Principle.
Mm-hmm.
The Peter principle was that people got promoted to their highest level of incompetence. And if Fillmore had stayed as the comptroller of New York State, he might have gone down in New York history as the greatest comptroller, treasurer for the state of New York. He was a good money man. He was a good numbers man. He knew how to balance a budget. He knew how to project tax revenues. And he might have gone down in history as a guy who helped secure New York's even greater dominance of the economy because he was such a great comptroller. He would have gone back to Buffalo, where he founded the Buffalo Historical Society, where he helped found the University of Buffalo, and people would remember Fillmore as one of the great citizens of Buffalo. Instead, he goes off to this really catastrophic presidency.
And then after, as you've told the story, after was really it came into disrepute because of the things that he said about the war, about emancipation.
Right.
Was the presidential candidate of the Know Nothing Party, notoriously anti-Catholic, anti-Semitic, anti-foreigner, anti-everything. And he really ends up from, if you consider to be the president of the United States, one of the top spots that you can have in this country, really ends up being a person who dies in obscurity and disgrace.
That's right. I mean, when he dies, nobody notices. I suppose that would go back to the Will Rogers quote, you know, when they, because Will Rogers also said about Calvin Coolidge, somebody told me President Coolidge was dead. How could you tell? Now the problem with Fillmore is that he disgraces himself during the war, not only by opposing emancipation, but by denouncing the war effort and really saying that the United States should not be fighting to preserve the Union. There were significant numbers of Northerners who were uncomfortable with emancipation, but they were all in agreement that the Union should be preserved, that you can't allow a group of hotheads, a group of sore losers, to destroy the Union. I mean, from the Northern perspective, Southerners had won almost every presidential election since the Constitution was written. They had dominated the government, they dominated Congress, they dominated the Supreme Court. Suddenly, a Northerner wins the presidency, and seven states say, well, we're not going to be in the United States because we didn't get our candidate elected. That's not how you run a democracy. You can't say we're quitters because we don't like the outcome of the game. They were happy to play the game as long as they were the winners. And so Northerners saw secession initially as a violation of the fundamental notions of democracy. They made a big distinction between, say, the Revolution of 1776, because the Americans had not been part of the political system in England. Americans didn't vote. Americans didn't send people to Parliament. And, in fact, they kept saying taxation without representation is what we're opposed to. They weren't opposed to paying taxes. They were opposed to not being represented in Parliament. But it would be hard to claim that Southerners weren't represented in the national government. At the time of secession, there were a majority of Southerners on the Supreme Court. Probably most of the leading generals in the Army were Southerners. In Congress, there had been far more Southern speakers of the House than Northern speakers of the House. The Senate had been dominated by Southern senators. There was no reason that anyone could plausibly argue the South had been disfranchised, but they lost an election, so they left, and so Americans said, you can't do that. Fillmore eventually says, let them go. End the nation, because they're not happy.
Just one tiny story. We're almost out of time. Just one tiny story that I like, although it may be more indicative of insecurity than humility, was when Oxford offered him an honorary degree, and it was written in Latin, and he couldn't read Latin, and he said something like, you know, I don't think anybody should accept a degree that he can't read.
Yeah, I don't think it's the humility. I think he was afraid he'd be embarrassed. It turned out that the Oxford students in those days were a pretty rowdy bunch, and they often hissed and booed at whoever got an honorary degree. And they probably would have, in fact, yelled at him in Latin or something, knowing that he couldn't answer them, so he declines an honorary degree. What else is fascinating about this? He goes on tour. He goes on the grand tour after his presidency, travels all over Europe, meets the Pope. And he's very concerned about meeting the Pope because he thinks he's going to have to kiss the Pope's ring and kneel. And here he's spent his entire life being anti-Catholic. But when he's told that he won't have to kiss the ring and he won't have to kneel, then he goes and he meets the Pope, and he's delighted to meet the Pope. And a week later, he accepts the nomination as the know-nothing candidate for president, running on this just viciously anti-Catholic ticket. And so he's so insecure that he can't resist meeting the Pope because the Pope's such an important person. But at the same time, he turns around and says, now I'm going to run against all Catholics in America.
Well, there we'll have to stop on that note. Our guest this morning is Paul Finkelman. He's professor of law at Albany Law School and is the author of a biography of Millard Fillmore, and that's the title. It is published by Times Books, part of their presidential biography series, and you can seek it out in the bookstore, and I'm sure that you would find it fascinating. And I appreciate Professor Finkelman, appreciate you very much talking with us today.
It's been a delight. Thank you very much, and I say hi to all my friends in Champaign-Urbana.
All right.
WILL programs are made possible by Strawberry Fields Natural Food Store. Strawberry Fields offers natural vitamins, health and beauty products, household cleaning products, pet foods, and an in-store nutritionist to answer questions about healthy eating. Strawberry Fields on Springfield Avenue in Urbana.
The Focus program that you just heard comes from the archive. It's a show that we first broadcast in August of last year, and there's a lot there on the archive. It's an opportunity to listen to programs you might have missed the first time around, so you can go there and check the schedule and see what's there. It's will.illinois.edu. Tomorrow morning on the program, we will be talking in the first hour about municipal electric aggregation for Champaign and Urbana. And what this is... in the March primary, when people here in Champaign-Urbana go to the polls to cast their votes, they'll see a question there on whether or not to establish municipal electric aggregation programs for their individual communities. These programs allow communities the option of buying bulk electricity for residents. That can mean substantial discounts in cost and also the opportunity to purchase cleaner, greener energy. So we'll be talking about just what this is, how it would work, what are some of the pros and cons on the program tomorrow? And we will have three guests joining us. Dennis Schmidt, he's the Director of Public Works for the City of Champaign. Charlie Smythe, he's an alderman from the City of Urbana. And also joining us by telephone will be David Colata. He is the Executive Director of the Citizens Utility Board. So we'll try to answer just as many questions as we possibly can. Then in the second hour tomorrow, we'll have a conversation with a candidate in the March primary. We've been doing this for a number of candidates in our area, for the State House and for the Congress. And tomorrow in the 11 o'clock hour, the guest will be Frank Metzger. And he is one of three Republicans seeking their party spot on the ballot in the new 13th Congressional District. It's quite a big district. It begins in Champaign-Urbana and stretches southwest all the way to the Mississippi. And Mr. Metzger is from a small community that is about 20 miles from St. Louis, so he's from all the way on the other end of the district. But he'll be with us in the studio, so you'll have the opportunity to hear from him and talk with him. And that's what we got up for tomorrow. And again, you want to check the schedule for the days ahead, find out what we will be doing. All you got to do is go to the website. That's will.illinois.edu.
Support for Stock and Commodity Reports on Illinois Public Media comes from Strategic Farm Marketing in Champaign, now hosting risk management seminars. A complete list of seminars is at sfarmmarketing.com. We would like to thank these businesses for helping to make our 22nd annual All-Day Ag Outlook meeting in Covington a great success. Strategic Farm Marketing, Boulder Design, Stuart Peterson, and Pioneer Seeds. We look forward to seeing you all again next year.
Up next, the Afternoon Magazine, the host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. This is WILL, 580 AM.
and 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana, online at will.illinois.edu. Let's take a look at commodity prices now. Just 1 minute before noon Central Time in Kansas City, March wheat, 677, down 3/4. The May contract, 679, down 4 3/4. March wheat, Chicago, 630 3/4, down 2 1/4. May, 635 1/4, down 4. March corn, 640, down 3 3/4. May, 634, down 4 3/4. July, 635 1/2, down 4 1/2. The September contract, down 3 5. 86 1/2. March soybeans, 1328, up 6 1/2. May, 1332 1/2, up 5 3/4. July, 1339 1/2, up 6. August, 1329 1/4, up 3 1/2. March soybean meal, 360.10, down 80. March oil, 53.20, up 59. April live cattle, 126 even. That's up 42 1/2. The June contract, up 75 at